This week on Making Contact.
I was in my office across the street looking through the window, and a crew of men in white suits, full-on white suits like they were on the moon, the moon suits, with digging equipment, and they were here for weeks.
Richmond, California, one of the lowest-income communities in the San Francisco Bay Area, is also one of its most heavily polluted.
There has been spills or fires where our whole, you know, playground was engulfed in just smoke where you couldn't see anything and, you know, your teacher's like, come inside.
On this edition, we'll hear how community activists in this highly polluted area are coming together to fight for environmental justice. I'm Jen Chien, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Richmond, California is located in the San Francisco Bay Area, world-renowned for its natural coastal beauty. Though Richmond enjoys the ocean breezes like many of its Bay Area neighbors, those breezes often come laden with chemical fumes, hazardous waste residues, and particulate matter. Residents here suffer from pollution-related ailments, from headaches, skin rashes, and nosebleeds, to cancer, heart disease, and asthma. Richmond's child asthma rates are the highest in its county. The city's landscape is dotted with toxic pollution sites. But in recent years, Richmond's also become a leader in the growing environmental justice movement, due in large part to lots of grassroots community action. Local resident Sherry Padgett has spent the last decade fighting for the cleanup of a former chemical manufacturing plant along Richmond's south shoreline. Making Contact's Sarah Bernard has the story.
The San Francisco Bay Trail along Richmond's south shoreline feels natural. Grasses rustle in the breeze, mallards bathe in the muddy lagoons. But Sherry Padgett, whose business is blocks from the water here, says that those puddles the ducks are swimming in aren't exactly lagoons.
They were known as the Chemical Pond A and Chemical Pond B, as in a chemical evaporation pond. Consultants suggested that they rename these two bodies of water to be upper and lower lagoons.
Padgett, owner of Cray Cabling, has a personal investment in the land here.
My office is here on the east side of the old Zenica Stauffer chemical plant, and my home is on the west side of the UC Richmond Field Station, so I am like sandwich bread for these two sites in between. And it's pretty toxic stuff in between.
And she knows a lot about that toxic stuff. A corner of her office is stacked waist high with boxes of documents. And she says she has the same amount at home.
And I've read all of it. So if we opened these, you'd find notes and tags, lots and lots. You can see it's pretty dense.
Padgett can reel off a dizzying list of toxic chemicals found here.
All of the DDXs, the DDD, DDE, DDT.
Chemicals like arsenic, lead, zinc, mercury, DDT, and PCBs. She can tell you how volatile organic compounds degrade into chemical structures more toxic than their original forms.
In this case, it's trichloroethane, and I think there's also some PCE, some tetrachloroethane.
Padgett and her husband moved their electric cabling business to South 49th Street in Richmond in the late 90s. At the time, she says, the lot across the street was a busy industrial campus.
The parking lots would fill up with employees every morning, and they would empty late at night. And these were chemists, engineers, scientists coming to work at the Zenica Ag Products chemical plant. They were keeping their employees safe, presumably, keeping the environment safe, presumably.
But a few years later, everything changed.
It was in late 2000, early 2001. I was in my office across the street looking through the window, and a crew of men in white suits, full-on white suits like they were on the moon, the moon suits, with digging equipment, and they were here for weeks. Anyone who was here during that time will never forget it. I was here in my office, and there's a dumpster outside, a white dumpster in front of the building. And as they were digging, the top of that dumpster would be covered with different colors of materials. Sometimes it would be yellow, sometimes brown, sometimes black. Sometimes it would be very fine, sometimes grainy, sometimes it would be sticky. It was so dirty. It was filthy. We had a business to run. I went out with a broom, push broom, and I would come in and go to the restroom and I'd wipe off my arms with a towel. But the stuff was in my hair and it was on my face and I was breathing it in.
It turns out, Paget learned, the city of Richmond had quietly issued Zeneca a permit to demolish the entire facility.
There were no inspections. There were no reports. There were no regulators involved. They just, one by one, across the street, started taking down the buildings. And these are buildings that had formulated things like all of the DDXs, superphosphate fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, many of which are in the 10 which have been banned around the world, were formulated across the street here.
Before Zeneca bought the plant, Stauffer Chemical Company had been operating here for nearly a century. Among other things, Stauffer manufactured sulfuric acid, produced by roasting pyrite that had been trucked down from the Iron Mountain Mine in Redding, California, one of the most toxic sites in the country, according to the EPA. The mine's current owner was subject to a $1 billion cleanup settlement with the EPA in 2000.
One of the questions that was asked multiple times was, okay, this is one of the most toxic sites in the country. Where did all this material go? Well, guess what? It's across the street.
Instead of paying $100 million or more to haul out all of the site's toxic waste, Zeneca had hired local consultants Levine and Fricke Recon to dig up some of it, bring in clean soil and limestone to neutralize the acidic material, and cap it all with concrete.
They diluted all of this material and put it right back where they dug it up.
At the time, Paget says, she knew nothing about it.
I honestly didn't think about it. It didn't occur to me that this was bad stuff. I'm talking now as though I knew the whole time what was going on across the street. I was clueless. And then I got really sick. I started growing this tumor. It was a cartilage tumor, which turned into an extremely rare bone cancer on my left chest wall. And one thing led to another, and I had that cut out of my left chest. They cut out a tumor the size of the front of my fist, along with five ribs, part of my sternum, and all of my left abdominal muscles, and put in a mesh patch prosthesis to hold me in. 9 months later, I was diagnosed with a rare thyroid cancer. At first, they couldn't believe it because they said it was nearly impossible to have two cancers within a year. But sure enough, it was. So they took out the thyroid in July of 2004. I felt like if this was living, I did not want to live.
Paget became determined to find out what had really been going on across the street.
In between, I'd come back to work and I'd talk to a lot of the neighbors here because so many of them were ill. And a lot of their conditions were thyroid-related, heart-related, odd tumors, odd lumps. Out of the 300 people who worked in this area, 30 got pretty sick, and out of those, 11 died. We don't know if they were all related. We have no idea. There's no way to prove it. So the California Department of Public Health looked into it, and their report says they had a hard time getting people to talk to them. What they did conclude was that there was no way to prove that the digging that had gone on across the street had anything to do with anyone's problems.
When Paget's health gradually improved over time with a lot of chronic pain,
I thought about what it meant to be alive and make a contribution to our society. And as I started to read more, I understood that I was gaining knowledge that other people didn't have. And I had a voice. I could write, I could speak, I could share what I was finding out with others if I spoke the truth. And the community came along.
In 2004, the real estate developer Cherokee Simeon Ventures bought the land and came to the city of Richmond with a plan to build 13-story apartment buildings there. Eric Bloom, a filmmaker who built his business a block away from the Zeneca site in 1998, remembers showing up at the meeting out of curiosity.
somebody asked about the chemical plant that was there and the toxins in the soil, and they said, we're going to build fans in the parking underneath the building and blow out the toxins as they come up through the soil. It was a fantasy.
The community urged the California EPA to switch the site's lead regulatory agency from the State Water Resources Control Board to the Department of Toxic Substances Control, DTSC, in 2005. Since it took over, the DTSC has reviewed cleanup proposals that Cherokee Simeon and Zeneca have submitted for different parts of the site. But it's been 7 years, and Sherry Padgett doesn't feel like much has happened. In October 2012, Cherokee Simeon filed for bankruptcy.
Cherokee's out of the document writing process now, so now it's solely on Zeneca. And they're motivated to spend as little as possible to keep the site in as static a state as they can and to delay, and to do as little as possible. DTSC has a lot of regulators who have gone through furloughs. The state of California is out of money. And so, you know, they're kind of tired. And they're not really motivated to get up and take on one of the world's Fortune 250 corporations. That's a headache. So we're in limbo right now. We're in kind of a no-action zone.
But after a decade of investigations, protests, and plans that haven't gained much traction, that no-action zone may be coming to a close. The University of California's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory has plans to build a second campus at the UC Richmond Field Station, which shares a boundary with the Zeneca site. By 2017, the development will bring thousands more people to the area and transform the Richmond shoreline. Eric Bloom says he's more hopeful.
Right now, there's the most pressure that there has been in 12 years. There's the most potential, I think, for something to actually happen now.
Mayor Gail McLaughlin has been coming to nearly every community meeting about the site for the past 7 years. She says that as part of the city accepting the lab's proposal, she made it clear that the Zeneca site would have to be cleaned up first.
I think it's more clear that whoever is going to do and pay for the work, it has to be done.
But for now, Sherry Padgett walks along the shoreline, knowing too well how toxic it is.
The most difficult thing to reconcile while you're out here is the natural beauty compared to the level of toxicity. The toxins out here are silent and insidious. The public really has no idea how bad this is. How could they know?
That story was produced by Sarah Bernard. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Richmond, California doesn't just deal with toxic waste from manufacturing and industry, but it's also home to one of the country's largest and oldest oil refineries, owned by Chevron. The Chevron refinery processes up to 240,000 barrels of crude oil a day and spews a potent mix of toxins, including the carcinogens benzene, butadiene, and nickel, all within a mile of homes, businesses, and even two elementary schools. Reporter Kyungjin Lee gives us a closer look at the refinery's impact on Richmond residents.
The San Francisco Bay Area is home to Richmond, California, as well as four major oil refineries in Contra Costa County: Chevron, Phillips, Martinez Refining Company, and Tesoro Golden Eagle emit highly polluting gases such as carbon dioxide, benzene, and sulfur dioxide. These businesses lay in close proximity to residential neighborhoods. Oil refineries aren't the only polluters in Richmond. The area also hosts numerous other chemicals and industrial factories that emit toxins. Sandy Saturn, an organizer with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, or APEN, says there's a connection between the pollutants oil refineries and other businesses release and the diseases that residents deal with.
There's very high rate of asthma and folks suffering or either pass away from cancer. So definitely we know the environment and Chevron and other kind of oil refineries being here is really affecting the health of, you know, not just the youth, but also the seniors.
Both State of California and independent research shows a higher prevalence of asthma in Richmond compared to state and national averages. A Contra Costa Health Services report said the county ranked second in breast, ovarian, and prostate cancer occurrence among the 15 most populated counties in California. Richmond's hospitalization rate for female reproductive cancers is more than twice the country's overall rate. Aside from the high levels of respiratory diseases, residents of this bayside town must also contend with water contamination. According to the San Francisco Regional Water Quality Monitoring Board, all creeks and bays in West Contra Costa County are impaired. For example, Castro Grove, a shallow, protected embayment of San Pablo Bay, has shown to contain mercury and selenium, among other hazardous pollutants. These chemicals are a direct result of discharge released from Chevron. Jessica Tovar, an organizer for Communities for a Better Environment, or CBE, said her group has battled oil companies that disposed polluted waters into the San Francisco Bay in the 1990s.
If you go out to the bay waters, you see people fishing all the time. They're pretty much fishing from the bay that Chevron Richmond and other facilities dump their wastewater into, and there's a huge issue with that. It's a community health issue, and it's a, you know, environmental pollution issue.
Aside from the slow but steady contamination from the everyday operations, Richmond residents have emergency spills to contend with. Accidents at a refinery trigger an emergency system called Shelter in Place. Residents hear a siren, and an automated phone call alerts people to close all the doors and windows and to stay inside until it's safe. Say Turn, who grew up in North Richmond, says she's dealt with adverse health effects because she lives so close to the refinery.
I went to the elementary school, Perry's Elementary, that's right in front of Chevron, so just across the train tracks from Chevron, and there has been spills or fires where our whole, you know, playground was engulfed in just smoke where you couldn't see anything, and, you know, your teacher's like, come inside, and what we did was just get a napkin, cover our mouth and nose, went on buses and drove around for a couple hours until it was supposedly safe to come back for our parents to pick us up. Every time there is a shelter, you know, in place or a warning, there's hundreds and thousands of people in the emergency room. So I remember in my lifetime growing up in North Richmond, I had to go for three different explosions, kind of fire spills, where I was in the emergency room with thousands of other people trying to get seen. And so my eyes would get blurry and my whole, you know, body would be covered with rashes. And so I would have the reaction the same day that the emergency happens. And so there's those kind of small, you know, effects that are showing that Chevron and General Chemical and all these other polluting, you know, refineries are impacting our health, whether it's cancer when you're 50 or 60 or 8 years old and in the hospital for, you know, allergic reactions like vomiting and rashes. They do take a toll on our body and our health.
Throughout the 1980s and 90s, community organizations like CBE and APEN worked to rein in some of these health impacts through educating and organizing the community, as well as lobbying and filing lawsuits. But another obstacle they faced was a Richmond City Council that solidly supported Chevron. Mayor Gail McLaughlin said until a few years ago, Chevron had a strong hand in city politics.
The large majority of city council members at that time had not been able to break from the grip of Chevron in terms of everything from special tax perks to just in general, their large numbers of campaign contributions. And I remember as a candidate for council, I would say things like, at that time we had a 9-person city council, and saying, well, really we have 10 city council members, 9 council members, and Chevron, because they seem to have a voice on the council.
McLaughlin said Chevron's financial support of city council candidates gave the company unique rewards. From 1992 until 2005, Chevron was allowed to appoint its own inspector with little oversight by city officials. McLaughlin and other critics of the deal said Chevron was allowed to skirt labor, environmental, and zoning regulations.
Chevron used to have the right to self-inspect itself on any permits that it had. So I was a co-sponsor of an initiative to stop the self-inspection ordinance that only Chevron made use of.
Richmond residents, most of whom are low and moderate income people of color, have made great strides in improving their environment over the past two decades. Mayor Gail McLaughlin said Richmond politics have evolved to be able to stand up to Chevron.
Richmond is in the forefront of showing that a united community and a vigilant community can bring a large oil company into what is in the interest of the community and certainly doesn't harm the profit base of this large corporation.
Local residents and activists know Chevron isn't going anywhere. They know there has to be some give and take. Sandy Saturn believes there is a way to work together so all parties can benefit.
They're here for the long haul, and so is the community. And I think it's time really to put our heads together to think about, you know, what's good for not just the people, but the environment with this global warming and climate crisis. We need to come together and think about what's good for the people and the environment and green jobs and solar and other types of ways to create energy.
For Making Contact, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
Communities for a Better Environment, or CBE, is just one of the many groups that's been fighting for a cleaner, healthier Richmond. I recently spoke to CBE's Northern California Program Director, Niall Malloy, about the refinery, community organizing, and environmental justice.
So in this show, we have heard about a couple of different situations in Richmond, California in particular. So the old Zeneca Stauffer chemical plant and also the Chevron refinery and several refineries really around Richmond. Can you talk a little bit about a community like Richmond? Why has it become such a site for toxicity and pollution?
Well, historically, I mean, this, Chevron's been there, Stand Oil been there for over 100 years. And so as a city, its land use, the primary land use of the city was for industrial sources, a big percentage of it. And so you have not only one pollution source at Chevron, but you have other, you have the port, and all these sources kind of cause more intensify of toxins. And actually, if you do the research, has caused a lot of health impacts. So that's the correlation between the history of Richmond, but also the history also includes, you know, migrations of African-American folks working at the ports and people just being there. You know, those are good jobs, you know, and those good jobs has a cost. You know, a lot of those folks got sick when they came out here, and there's a history of that kind of health concerns in that community since then, where a lot of the kind of leadership in the community, like, you know, Dr. Henry Clark and others, who's been very vocal about not only what's happening at the Chevron refinery, but the other polluting facilities that try to improve them, make them better, and also to ensure community benefits. You know, these corporations and businesses are making a lot of money at the expense of people's health. A lot of those folks are, a lot of them are Latino African American communities or even working class communities, are faced with the greatest burden of this pollution impact. These communities are the communities that are first worst and impacted by the environmental injustice, and these are the first communities that actually needs to get the investments to be cleaner, to be greener, to be more vibrant, to have access to food. And Richmond is a good microcosm of that, because it's happening, it's been happening, and there's been a huge voice to bring these concerns to the table, and actually a political shift, you know, happening in the community from, you know, having a Green Party mayor to just having more of a vibrant environmental justice voice. And also those who see that, you know, there needs to be more accountability just throughout the city.
In August of 2012, a huge fire at the Chevron refinery sent clouds of black smoke billowing over Richmond and neighboring towns. Residents throughout the whole of Contra Costa County were warned to stay indoors. No Chevron employees were injured, but over 14,000 residents were seen at area hospitals during that time, mostly for respiratory or eye problems.
So let's talk a little bit about the fire and what's happened after the fire.
So you have this, you know, huge community and also surrounding areas. You see this large black plume just blow up and, you know, freaked a lot of people out. To a lot of the kind of community that live adjacent, wasn't the first time, you know, they've seen, you know, things like that before, or know the refinery does flaring and things like that. But this was a little bit different because of how the darkness of the plume was. And there's questions about emergency response. There was questions around how the community was notified, questions about emergency preparedness. So there have been several kind of city council meetings to address it. You know, we held a town hall meeting to bring community voices to the table. There was, you know, it brought in both state and also federal attention from the Chemical Safety Board. So people immediately wanted, you know, to protect the community and the health and safety of workers. To really resolve what the actually root cause of the problem was in terms of repairs, and also ensuring that whatever repairs that there were, that there would be the most technology sound, most efficient, most effective technology, so it wouldn't happen.
It sometimes seems like, although it's tragic when these events happen, that sometimes that's what it takes to create an opening for the company to have to listen to the community.
And that's exactly what happened. I mean, they responded. There was a couple community meetings. Like I said, city council was up space for that. But all in all, it takes still a lot of community persistence, because there's a disconnect between community voices and then just the city itself and how they operate with Chevron, and then the Chevron influence over the city. We've simultaneously saw it as an opening as well as an organization. And so we started building a labor and community collaborative with the United States Steelworkers, NRDC, Asian Pacific Environmental Network, the Blue Green Alliance, and others, are trying to figure out how can we collectively not be used to divide and conquer around these kind of basic issues and making sure that the refinery is held accountable. And so more recently, the refinery was actually given $1 million of fines, several different accounts, primarily around safety and health. The fines revealed that, you know, a lot of the community groups were right on, in terms of that we really needed a state, federal agency with some teeth, some policies to really move that forward. Post the explosion, the governor actually created a refinery task force, which we are part of with the labor and health and occupation program at UC Berkeley, who's really spearheading that. I think it's a tragic story in terms of who was impacted, but it also has fruit in terms of how it brought us as together as a labor community collaborative to really rethink and think about the future around these issues.
That was Niall Malloy, Northern California Program Director at Communities for a Better Environment. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Redman is our executive director. Andrew Stelzer and George Lavender, producers. Irene Flores, web editor. Lisa Bartfi, Salima Hamarani, and Aaron Mathewson, production interns. And Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, and Alton Bird, volunteers. I'm Jen Chien. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.